Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for your patience. I am Megan Pressman. I'm the Associate Managing Director here at Berkeley Rep, and welcome to A Symphony of Ideas, a conversation about the body and the body politic. We're very excited about your interest and to have this discussion with you. I'd like to invite our moderators and panelists up on stage and introduce you to them. Come on up. This is a casual evening.
This is for you two to share.
Hey.
Right there.
So good to see you. It's so great to see you.
Right?
And this is for you. I just want to do a couple brief thank yous and introduce everybody before we get started. A special thanks to Ms. Smith and Mr. Costello, our co-moderator. They have put a lot of careful thought and care in assembling this panel, and I'm so excited that they're interested in extending this conversation to those of you who are interested in having it with us. And these are our very exciting panelists. At the end, we have Dr. Judith Butler, and you all have, welcome, thank you. You all have the bios in your hands. We have longer bios of our illustrious panelists online if you want to check them out, so I won't waste time doing that. Next to her is Ms. Janice Mirakatani. Dr. Arnold Milstein. And Lance Williams. I want to thank our co-sponsor, Kaiser Permanente, for making all of this possible. Thank you. And I also want to let you know that there will be two more panel post-show discussions, at least so far, the next following Wednesday nights. If you want to know more about them, they're hosted by the Graduate Theological Union, and those information is also on our website under the Let Me Down Easy page. Those will also be pretty terrific. And I want to let you know that this discussion is being audio recorded and will be available for free podcast on our website shortly. And with that, I think that's all I have to share with you, and please enjoy the discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for staying, and thanks, everyone, for coming out. I want to start by asking the panel a pretty simple question. If you were pressed to say what the play was about, what would you say? Judith?
Well, I think that the play moves between our fundamental fears, anxieties, hopes, exhilarations about death, and the question of whether anyone will be treated in the way that they deserve, given the politics, the policies, the structure of the world as it is. And it seems to me that some of the monologues really bring out exhilaration in the face of death, or pride, or toughness, or wishfulness, and others bring out fear and anxiety, or what individuals can do for one another. But what traverses so many of them is the larger question of whether everybody can be treated like a prince, and whether there's hope that one might be ushered out of this world in a way that has some kind of dignity and knowledge.
Janice.
I would say that it was a very life-affirming play. And I've known Anna for, I'm not going to say how many decades, but...
I've performed you.
Yes, you have. No comment. Cecil is out in the audience. Yes. Cecil Williams, Reverend Cecil Williams. We happen to be married to one another, but we've also worked together for 45, almost going on 50 years at Glide Church. And we do have a clinic in which we've built over the last 10 years, which is now emphasizing this whole thing about wellness. And what I think the play about is the enormous contradictions that we as human beings have to contend with in this society. And I think your play was about social justice and the injustice that we see in classism and racism and those conditions, the diseases that continue to plague us in this country. For example, when you were doing Eve, and you did everybody, I just couldn't believe how quick, I mean, I'm shell-shocked, kind of, because you just did everybody, and you were everybody, and so genuinely, and Eve, who I saw just recently, she's talking about anorexia and the disappearance of women, and the need for women to disappear in order to be approved of, and we work with people so they go hungry to disappear, and we work with people who are hungry, literally, because we feed about 1 million meals a year, and who are hungry to appear, to be visible, because the poor are invisible. Mm-hmm. And, the contradiction of spending $6 billion a day on a war. When we do the math, we could feed people for 99 years at Glide and 1 million meals a year. So all of the striking contradictions of what is life and what does death really mean came up for me. I'm talking too much.
What drew my attention in particular was the central theme of human struggle to cope with ineffectiveness in all of its forms, and the accentuated version of that struggle that occurs near the end of life, and the resources that the health system could provide in helping with that struggle, and substantial shortfalls in the delivery of those resources.
Yeah, I'm a journalist. I reacted to that as a piece of reporting, first of all, and it was excellent reporting to get those people to open up, to give us a view, you know, with the artifice stripped away, that essential spark of humanness that we all share, and then overlay all the structural issues that give some of us an easy exit to this world and good care, and others not so easy, but the journalism, if I could say it, was pretty darn impressive. I do this for a living, and it's not easy to get people going like that.
Each of you have talked about death, and as Phil Pizzo, the dean of the medical school at Stanford, said, the lack of time spent on preparing for death, he says, it's a conversation that doesn't take place. But we rarely have frank and honest conversations about death in this country. And in fact, a few years ago when we had the healthcare debate, death was put into the notion, a caricature, death panels. I wonder if any of you have thoughts on how do we move from here to where we need to be in having a honest discussion about death and end of life. Arnie, what do you think about that?
Well, I think that it's a sufficiently visible and poorly solved problem that despite opportunistic politicians who will contemporarily suppress progress, that the general direction of the healthcare system is toward progress in relation to its current failures in helping people struggle with the psychology of total loss, which is what death is. And for example, I think there are now 32 states that have passed laws similar to the law that was passed in California in 2009 that put into effect a mandatory a form called a pulsed. I can't remember what the acronym stands for, but it's essentially it's an opportunity for anyone in California and their parallel, you know, progress in 32 other states to be able to work out with their doctor exactly what they do want, and to make it an official part of the medical record and the doctor's orders, which gives it a much higher probability of being adhered to, and also as an extra inducement for the healthcare system to pay attention, also holds physicians harmless if in good faith they attempt to adhere to these jointly put together doctor's orders, jointly put together by the patient and the physician. So you know, as disappointing as some of the fluctuations in progress can be, I think the general direction is favorable, and there's an increasing appreciation that our current healthcare system is not performing well in this particular facet of helping people and caring for them, and the general direction of progress is very favorable.
I'm just wondering whether we can really call progress the increasing number of people who are without health insurance in this country and who find it unaffordable, and whose employment and whose employers, if they have them, are not actually supplying them with adequate health care. So there may be some progress in the way certain medical institutions are starting to address this issue more explicitly, but I think what we're really seeing is are more and more people dropped from healthcare and living with absolute anxiety about not only what their death might be like, but what their life is going to be like. Because between life and death is illness, and sometimes it's protracted, and without care, it's agony, and it's enormously frightening. So in that sense, I think we have not seen progress.
Well, I think we have to turn this whole discussion around, and the whole issue of healthcare on its head. You know, I think we need a revolution in the way in which we think. I think it's profitable to see people dying. I think there's profit in death. There's too much that is being spent on illness and not enough attention being spent on prevention. And I just feel like it requires, you know, that, like your Aunt Lorraine, it requires a community that will extend its arms so that we could put our hands underneath the arms and to be embraced by, you know, some kind of care that allows people to feel like they're worth being saved and having self-care before it's too late and they get a disease that you have to spend gazillions on to treat. So, you know, my feeling is, I mean, it's all like, you know, this contradiction that I feel came through in so many of your characters, and particularly, of course, I felt for the patients, because that's who we treated, are the poor. And they don't feel like they deserve to be healthy. They don't feel like they deserve health care or preventative care or self-care before they have pain. So, you know, I think educators, social workers, counselors, recovery stations, I think the battered women's centers, I think, you know, schools, young people, I think the whole issue around prevention and nutrition and, you know, obesity abatement and, you know, growing food or having children grow food so they can learn how to eat differently and more healthy. I mean, all of that is involved. It's the total kind of holistic wellness concept of how do you educate from an early age, you know, somebody to be healthy rather than to, you know, continue habits. And a lot of them are cultural. A lot of them have to do with class, because we know that poor people can't afford to eat healthy foods or they don't know how to eat healthily. But that we can begin to turn around if we are that community that cares enough to look at it in a more holistic way.
And then how do you think that that wellness strategy would then inform how we think about death? What would be how would you see that continuum?
I think that when you educate people about health, healthcare, what is necessary? I mean, I found out from just recently from the chancellor, the new chancellor at UCSF, that flossing can put 5 years on your life. Flossing your teeth. Okay. Well, I didn't know
start
that.
Flossing.
and dental flossing. Right. Well, you know, you talk about insurance. There is no dental insurance, and there is no education about what it is that it what is required for you to be a healthier human being. You know, we see people with diabetes. It's an epidemic of diabetes in this country, and it is an educatable issue, if you know what I'm saying. So in terms of, if you talk about death, to me it's talking about life. How do you improve the quality of life through self-care rather than being driven into the fear mode about dying?
So Arnie, how does preventative care fit into this matrix of healthcare spending and the dollars we spend, and how do we need to change the dynamic of the money that we spend on end of life to the money that we need to spend on preventative care?
Well, one of the many sources of wisdom about healthcare that I've learned from my wife is that, you know, if humans are biologically maybe selected via evolution to much more carefully attuned to what might be called fast-moving threats, you know, saber-toothed tiger, you know, jumping out from behind a rock, and slow-moving threats, which are what preventive care is designed to address, are difficult not only for the public but also for practitioners to home in on, because it's nowhere near as emotionally compelling as an immediate threat. In which the death and its consequences are so much more psychologically available. So I think it's not surprising that neither patients nor practitioners are as oriented toward prevention as they are toward doing something when loss of life is, or loss of ability to function, which is a symbolic form of loss of life, is more visibly at hand.
So do you floss your teeth?
Definitely.
Lance.
I just want to say both my brothers are dentists and they recommend.
That's it.
But I want to back for a second, because I wonder how you all feel about decisions about something as critical as how we die being given over to medicine when it's a community that many of us don't trust? Or is your doctor the person you really want to have that conversation with? And if not, where are the other places it can happen? Where are the other ways of thinking about it? Because, you know, I think Eve's statement is pretty strong. You know, we don't, even the reason we don't want to have old people around, right? The resources of wisdom, for example. We don't want old people around because they remind us that we're going to die. And people don't really die in this country, that we want to stay young. All the kinds of things that we do not to look old would be what she would talk about. But so is medicine the only place where this should be hashed out?
Well, we used to have ministers and spiritual advisors and stuff, and I know in my own family, and we've been confronted with actually sudden death of friends. Our Presbyterian minister was the man who helped me and my little kids through it, and perhaps someone like that will be there for me if when it's my time. I'm not sure if you've got a good doctor you have some rapport with, that would be great, but many doctors are technicians, aren't they? And that's not really what you're hiring them for, to talk that through. So it might not be the right place to look. Just a thought.
Well, I think that it is the total, it's the whole thing. I think you have to talk to your doctors, you have to talk to the community. I mean, I think everybody needs community. And I think community oftentimes requires doctors to be more caring. And we have experienced that. It's very lonely to be sick. It's a very lonely feeling to be sick. And if you have people who are around you and who guide you, who go with you to the hospital, who work with you, who counsel you, who, again, give you information. You know, support groups are also really important. We have a lot of different support groups dealing with cancer, with diabetes, with not just crack cocaine recovery, but with violence recovery, anger management, stress management, depression management. I mean, there's just all, I mean, it's not, and I'm not talking about just the quality of life. I'm talking about those contributors to death.
It seemed to me that there were some health practitioners that whom you portrayed this evening who had a set of values that maybe were not just medical values. In other words, I don't know, the woman who worked in the orphanage, she sat with people, and she sat with kids, and she talked to them, and she played with them, and she did not let them go alone. Or the Katrina woman, Kirsten, I believe, who really felt that it was her job as a medical practitioner to treat every person with great dignity and with equality. And even the head of the Yale, or the Societe at the Yale Medical School, she knew, she was treated poorly, she was treated well, she understood what the scene was, but she actually, she had the right values, and so she understood that no one's file should be lost, no one should be treated with that level of indifference. So the real question for me is not whether we look to medicine rather than to some other institutions, but whether the values that get embodied by practitioners are actually where they come from and what they share with other kinds of values that we might have. I mean, to what extent were some of those health practitioners a little bit like Effie? It's like, well, look, I can't bring your mother back, but here I am, and I'm 104, but you can put your hands underneath my, I presume, rather skinny arms and whatever heat I've got, you know, I'll give to you under these conditions because I'm here for you. I'm the substitute you've got. You know, it may not be kin. It may not be your closest person. It may not be the person you've loved and lost in this life, but I'm here and I'm opening those arms for your hands. And, you know, I mean, people do give like that, and they do understand that they're called upon at such moments to be there for another human being in loss or devastation. And the real question for me is whether that happens in a church or synagogue or in a completely secular environment or in a medical scene, you know, where does that come from? And it seems to me you found those moments in so many of the people you interviewed, so that even the very rich could at least indirectly acknowledge that they were getting what others didn't get and that it shouldn't be that way.
Lance, go ahead. Arnie, you have
this. I was going to say that one of the insights provided to me by Diane Meyer, who is sort of regarded as sort of America's leading palliative care practitioner, is that as she reflected on why it was that, you know, she was so often disappointed in her colleagues, particularly oncologists, who were very reluctant to support patients in this way, is that her view was that many of them were, by virtue of the strengths and weaknesses in their personalities, intolerant of the grief that they would feel if they were to open up this mm-hmm. kind of conversation. And I think it was a useful insight that the answer may not be to expect that every doctor can do it, but rather expect a healthcare system in which that capacity, whether it's on the team or part of referral to a minister in a community or training in Buddhism, which is another solution, that ought to be, you know, one of our aspirations for our healthcare system, that patients are not asked to face the scariness of end of life alone and without the kind of emotional support that they deserve.
You know, Arnie, you represent the medical community on this panel. Were you shocked by Hazel Merritt's story? Were you shocked by Kirsten Burke's story? Or is that a recognition of how the medical industry, healthcare, can be very impersonal and very harsh on individuals?
I was not surprised at all. You know, anybody who's even reasonably sentient has gone through medical training has run into second-year residents and senior attendings, very similar to that described by the physician at Charity Hospital. And it's partly a failure in who gets selected into medical schools. The criteria, you know, traditionally have not focused on dimensions like the ability to care and have empathy for other people. I think that the good news is if you begin to read the kind of the criticisms that are being made by medical educators about medical education, there's an increasing recognition that the selection criteria for medical school are in their current form insufficient to meet society's needs. And this is, and the, you know, selecting clinicians who are so intolerant of having any empathy for another person's suffering is hopefully will be a chapter that's soon closed mm-hmm. in American medicine.
Lance.
Go ahead. Janice.
I just want to tell a story. Can I tell a story?
Sure.
Because Cecil's been in and out of the hospital quite a bit. I can say that, right, honey? And he was in surgery for something like his knee or a knee replacement or one of those surgeries. And they were waking him up at 5:30, 6 o'clock every morning, bringing in a class full of residents or interns or whatever you call them. Okay. Anyway, so the doctor came in with 10 students, and they were poking him and prodding him and all of that. And on the third day, he really exploded, and he says, you know, this is really pissing me off. He says, this is inhumane. You're doing this to me, and, well, how do you treat other patients? I mean, my God. Because, you know, like, there were a lot of doctors that came in, and they knew him. So I said, you're treating me like this. How do you treat normal, regular people? I mean, do you just, like, poke and prod and, you know, like, do whatever you want in this inhumane way? And the nurses outside the room started singing We Shall Overcome. It's a great story because they, you know, it speaks exactly to that. I mean, I think that a lot of it has to do with, okay, if physicians adopt the values that they are the ones who are privileged and they're the ones who have your life and your care in their hands and you are vulnerable to them, then that's not such a good attitude, it seems to me, to instill in somebody who is going to be in a life and death profession where they have somebody's feelings, emotions, and their physical being in their hands. But I thought you would enjoy that story.
That's a wonderful story. One of the things that I think has happened to us is, on the one hand, you know, this play may cite many failures in the system, but it's ironically coming at a time when so many people are in the search of absolute professionalism, right? I mean, I faced this in teaching in a professional school at NYU. I'm sure you come across this too, this notion of being perfect, of being super professional, and maybe even the loss of care in doctors has to do with the great opportunity to know more and where science is and how maybe we're expecting too much of them. I'm wondering, Lance, if you would say something about how professionalism has affected professional athleticism and that kind of search for a kind of perfection that, different from what Michael Sandel, I just realized I'm thinking about, makes me think of his book, The Case Against Perfection, but the type of perfection that Sally Jenkins, the sports writer, is talking about, and you know, even the points that she says the Greeks would have ground up rhinoceros skin and eaten it if they thought it was going to make them run any faster. And yeah. You've certainly looked at drugs.
Well, Sally has a gladiatorial view of elite sports. and that's not to be critical. I mean, many people look at it that way. The young athletes themselves know they're never going to die, and they know that if only they can achieve their sports goal, everything will be great. There was a runner who was a character in the Balco scandal, a guy called Tim Montgomery, who set the 100-meter world record. And he did it by becoming a drug cheat, but he told his drug supplier, you know, I don't care what you give me. I don't care if I drop dead as I cross the finish line, as long as I can set that record. And he did set the record. So he was a gladiator, too. I suppose if we had a sports discussion, I would be arguing that we need adults to be in charge to protect those young people from their own competitive instincts. But certainly they believe they can be perfected, and if they can only get some additional edge, that'll all be achieved. Maybe that's responding to your question.
Yeah, I just want to say, it may be that there's a kind of interesting tension or even a contradiction in some of these characters, though, right? The desire for complete perfection and even immortality at the same time, willing to go out, right? Willing to be snuffed out, willing to be used up, willing to die in the middle of the competition as long as one gets that record. So it seems like there's a desire for immortality, but there might be something of a death drive in there too, you know, a kind of willingness to risk it all and not really caring about surviving as long as one reaches that goal.
Did the play change any of your views on healthcare, or did it harden your views on healthcare and the healthcare system? Janice?
I think it affirmed a lot of what I feel, and I think what we feel about healthcare and how the isms are the true diseases that we are facing and really need to address, the attitudes about the poor, the attitudes about privilege, and again, what you refer to as the values. I think the values need to be really addressed in the medical profession, in all the professions. I think there are a lot of broken systems in this country, and I think, you know, we hope that Obamacare, that healthcare reform, would move us in the right direction. But of course, I think, I'm sorry if there are Republicans in the audience, but they're really determined to kill
it. Well, I hope there are some.
Okay, well, I know I'm in Berkeley. I went to UC Berkeley, and I love UC Berkeley. I mean, I was in the free speech movement. I went that way back. But
there are definitely Republicans at UC Berkeley.
But I really think, yeah. I know a couple, actually. But I think the right wing is absolutely determined to kill it. Just like
well, there they are.
I didn't mean to offend you that much. Okay. But I think they're determined to make sure that Obama doesn't get a second term and almost to the point of sacrificing this country and the people in it. I mean, it's very scandalous. And I think what you do is affirm the necessity for us as human beings to be able to come together and see all of the various facets of the kaleidoscope that we are.
Arnie, the question was raised about that Janet just raised about healthcare reform and Obamacare, as some people call it. And increasingly, it's likely that the Supreme Court is going to deal with the individual mandate, which is a significant critical part of the healthcare reform. If the Supreme Court denies the individual mandate, eliminates the individual mandate, what happens to healthcare? How do we start again in this country? How can we start again in this country to devise something when the country is so divisive, such a chasm?
Well, I think that if the Supreme Court were to make such a decision, it would constitute a major impediment to, you know, the most, in some ways, the centerpiece of the law, which was to find ways of making healthcare affordable to everybody, and begin to do something about what had gotten close to 50 million Americans who were uninsured and generated an annual rate of death due to a condition called uninsurance that was estimated to be considerably in excess of 25,000 people a year. And so that would be the consequence. I think the only favorable note is that because healthcare is consistently growing faster than our national ability to pay for it, it's outgrowing the GDP, which is ultimately our ability to pay for it by about 2 to 3 percentage points a year. What happens is that if you don't solve for uninsurance and the kind of inequities that creates, you essentially begin to watch the problem penetrate up higher and higher into American income levels. And at a certain point, the population snaps. And I think that's one of the reasons, in fact, why they even got as many congressmen as they did to vote, is to begin for the first time to read stories in some of the national media, not about people making $25,000 a year who could no longer afford health insurance, but in the year before the healthcare reform law passed, there was, for example, a front page article in the New York Times about the Walkers, who were, you know, a Dallas family that ran their own business, sort of classic, you know, Republican target for recruitment. And the story was one of bankruptcy, losing their house, and now going on to being exposed to a state Medicaid program that at least in the state of Texas, is not what one characterizes as merciful. And it was a scary story for them. So I think that it would be a terrible setback and a real source of additional inequity and healthcare disparities in this country if we were to allow continuation of high rates of uninsured. But I think, you know, eventually, as the problem will inevitably penetrate up into higher levels of the income, there will be an American voter reaction. And at a certain point, no matter how much money you can put into, you know, political action committees, people start to feel pain, talk to their neighbors, and the equilibrium, and then the pendulum begins to swing back towards something that's a little bit more socially equitable.
Mm-hmm. Judith, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I actually would like to see the national health insurance issue reopened from the start. I'm afraid that as much as we identify with Obama and want him to be reelected because we don't really have another choice, I feel like he made some compromises that were actually rather problematic. And so putting national health insurance back on the table, I think, is really important. It seemed to me that the rodeo guy, what's his name?
Brent
talked about the flat fee, you know? That was like a great moment, the flat
fee.
That got
the biggest applause in the audience.
It was a great moment.
I like it that he's the most conservative person that I interviewed. He's a Republican right-wing bull runner.
Yeah, but he got it. He got it, flat fee. It was really good. And, you know, when I've traveled abroad, especially to Europe, and people were trying to follow our health insurance debates, and it was rather impossible. They basically said, so are you saying that it's not just FEMA who doesn't arrive, right, who decides which populations are going to be abandoned and which are not? Are you saying that people would say, are you saying that as a people, that the majority of people in the United States are willing to abandon some part of their population and not agree to a system that would allow everyone to be covered on it? I have to say yes. That's right. That's us. That's not just the government. That's the voting population. That's the problem. And it's that entire mindset that has to be changed. And I say, let's not worry about what the Supreme Court has to say about this particular provision. Let's open up that debate all over again.
We're going to take the questions from the audience in a minute. I just want to move down and ask each of you, what is the conversation that you hope that the audience has when they leave here tonight? Is there anything that you would like them to be talking about with their friends, loved ones as they leave? Lance?
You know, the part of the play that I needed the most or liked the most was giving voice to some of the poor people who lack care. They don't really have a voice in the debate that goes on, and the the FEMA segment especially, that really brought it home for me. And so I suppose I'd like people to think about the human beings behind the stats when we're arguing over this stuff.
I would hope that people who had a chance to watch this marvelous play would use it as a basis for inspiration for, you know, speaking to their neighbors about increasing one's expectations about what a healthcare system ought to be able to do. It's simply not enough for healthcare systems to be technically excellent, and a healthcare system that can't reasonably address, either directly or by referral, patients' emotional and spiritual needs is just one form of an ill-equipped healthcare system. It's symbolically the equivalent of, you know, not having oxygen available in a hospital, and beginning to ramp up, you know, and increase Americans' expectations of what they ought to be getting for the amount of money they're spending is what I hope people would take back and spread.
You know, I agree with that. I feel like what art does is it brings us, it connects us all together, and really just bottom line lets us know that we all share common fears and common feelings, and, you know, that when you humanize a person who is poor, when you humanize someone who is isolated or abandoned, whether it's by a natural disaster or by their circumstances or condition, that is what brings us together. But I hope the audience would be like the ripples, you know, that expand the circles, that say, you know, we can't leave it to Obama, we can't leave it to the politicians, we can't leave it to any single section or segment of society to fix this, because it's just really broken. And it requires all of our efforts, I think, to come together, to begin to have that meaningful dialogue about what can be done. And I think, again, I have to always go to community. I always have to say the hope is in community, and the hope is in us talking to one another and continuing to be voice and bring voice to one another.
Well, I guess I would say that I hope people really take stock of what an extraordinary performer Anna Deavere Smith is. Yeah, I guess I would just add, I think she brings worlds together that don't otherwise know how to be in contact with one another. And she's been doing that for her entire career. And, you know, there's a certain kind of, I guess I would call it a kind of critical empathy that allows her to enter into another person's speech and mode of standing and speaking and sitting and coughing. And it's extraordinary, and I think it's something of a guide to those of us who maybe come to snap judgments too quickly or fail to listen or think we don't have anything in common with the person that we're sitting next to or the one who lives in a different state from the one we live in. Anyway, I just want to thank you.
Please, everyone, thank the panel. We have a few minutes to take questions from the audience. Do we have mics in the audience? Or?
I got one.
Okay,
I got one.
Way up there.
Yeah, maybe we could have the lights up. Are they up as far as they can go in the audience?
I was glad to see that Lance was bold enough to say that he talked about death with a pastor. A pastor was there.
I
think that you're neglecting... I'm sorry, I haven't seen your play for a while. But I think that there's plenty of opportunity to talk about death within congregations, be they Christian congregations or Muslim or Jewish or what have you. And the faith communities are very comfortable with conversations about death. And the funny thing was is this afternoon at a meeting at my church, we got talking about death. And... you know, several of us in the congregation, I have Parkinson's myself, we're talking about talking about this and quite comfortable in it, so I don't think that the community is completely devoid of places to talk about death.
Other questions? Right over here.
I did over 300, and then it's too hard to explain how we get there.
Over here.
Sure.
Yes, you, glasses, standing up.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. To paraphrase Atul Gawande, Dr. Gawande, who wrote in The New Yorker, he was talking about medical profession looking at death as the enemy. And that is a barrier, really, to arriving at more humane solutions for end-of-life care. And I wonder if people would care to comment on that and on whether or not there's a way to perhaps look differently at the process of dying, or to train doctors to do so. And kind of as an add-on to that, I wonder, no one really has talked about how the insurance industry affects decisions about life and death.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if for-profit medicine is something that, you know, you would also like to talk about and its effect on the way we treat people who are ill.
It's a whole other play.
Who wants to grab that, Artie?
Well, I think there are many in the business world who haven't applied the level of nuance that was revealed in this play tonight as they think about, for example, their coverage rules. So not to pick on private insurance companies, but the Medicare program, for example, out of very good intention, forever has had a rule that if you want to be eligible for a hospice benefit, there's a certain degree of giving up on curative care. And many insurance companies, you know, follow that pathway, and a very innovative and imaginative leader, and I should say management team at Aetna, you know, one of the insurance companies that's, you know, classically, you know, villainized, reasoned that it made no sense to make it an either or choice. Why not give people the benefit of everything that technical medicine can do and make available an enhanced quality of life program that would include palliative care? They implemented that experiment about 8 years ago. It's written up in one of the healthcare journals, but it had the interesting effect of not only substantially improving quality of life, but in lengthening life itself. That there was something about having a team of professionals who were skilled in and interested in improving quality of life for people who were, you know, late in their struggle with illness, that actually lengthened their life.
I just want to tell you one little thing, that something you said made me think of this, and also the woman who talked about faith. Is, you know, Hazel, the woman who had a very bad experience with dialysis. Mm-hmm. So the way I got to her was her doctor said to me, you know, you should come up to Yale and talk to this patient of mine who's refusing dialysis. You might find that she's interesting. And so, you know, obviously I did that. She's in the play and all of this. The doctor, by the way, did not know Rashtigar, who's a fabulous, fabulous nephrologist, didn't know what she had been through and didn't learn it till he saw the play, and that help. No. But he was, you know, he saw the possibility, right, of this. So I found out she accepted dialysis. What he didn't know was that his resident was born again, as was Hazel. And he was sneaking in there praying with Hazel. And he got her to come around. because her whole thing was, it's all about my faith. And what so many of you are calling for is a larger circle. And it seems hard to have it happen, but I do hear that. It pleases me that I'm hearing that, it seeds of that in what each one of you say. That's very simplistic, I know, but just made me think about that resident going in there and praying with Hazel. You saw the play tonight or another night?
About a month ago.
Why did you come back tonight?
Because I was so curious about how I differ, I think, from everybody. And I was so curious to really hear what was going to be said. I don't feel that there was enough about the health system. And as it was advertised, I think it spoke more to death and dying. But it didn't speak to it in a way that I thought was as complex a process as it is. And I think in going with an individual through the hospital, through the healthcare, would have captured the wholeness of that, of what happened. And again, I obviously am in a real minority here, but I
don't know that.
Thank you.
Stage right. Final question.
I have a really interesting example of how subjective art is, because it spoke to me so specifically, because I've been doing theater for social change for the last 4 years. I'm at like this really big point in my life, so my voice might get shaky, and I don't know how to ask the question astutely. But I'm going back to school for acupuncture in the fall. And I'm at this very intense place around where my gut and my passion is. And it's in performance. And it's in journalistic theater. But I cannot handle the stress of the finances. And I'm going back to school to study medicine. And the people that spoke to me the most in your show last night was the rodeo guy and the boxer, and the way they talked about when you no longer pursue your passion, you've died. And I'm going to go to school part-time so that I can keep it going. But there was a huge part of me watching you on the stage that was just like, you know, I have a really big heart for people, and I'm going to get into medicine. And I'm never gonna do a show like this at Berkeley Rep. And I'm a writer, and I was just watching it, and my heart was in so many different places throughout the course of your show. Around, around that, around the passion factor, and then also watching the woman who worked at the hospital in Katrina and just being like, talking about the way she could make those patients feel. And, you know, the Buddhist, ending it with the Buddhist monk. And I was just like, how is it that some things just show up right at the perfect moment? And I don't know how to ask a question, but I feel like you could probably tell me something.
Well, I'm going to defer, because what interests me about post-play discussions, and in at Paul, who has, I first of all, please applaud Paul Costello, who's done many of these. I'm going to defer to Janice Mirakatani. And I'll tell you why. Because, like Janice, I would say that one of the things I saw the possibility from Janice and from Reverend Cecil Williams to take individuals and to create communities. And one of the very difficult things about doing theater, and even in my case of always wanting to open it up to hear what the audience has to say, and had a project at Harvard based on that for 3 years, is how, and anybody can answer this, I'm looking at you, Janice, how do we take the richness of individual concerns, anxieties, and wishes, and use the fact that we are together and that we have witnessed something together to make action, which requires that we step outside of what we liked, what we related to, what spoke to us, what didn't speak to us. So how can we, you've been calling for action, everyone up here has tonight. How do we take this opportunity of seeing art, which is, as this young lady has said, subjective, and ends up being about what I related to, identified with or not. And one reason I don't do long monologues is my project for 35 years has been about difference and multiple narratives. And the only way I could figure to do that in the theater was to bring multiple narratives. Mm-hmm. How do we take multiple desires, anxieties, and make communities?
Well, I sort of wish that Cecil had a microphone, because we've both been working very, very hard to bring about diversity, to make diversity a reality in our community. And, you know, it is what you accomplished tonight, I mean, and as you have in Talk to Me and many other productions that you have done and I've experienced, is that you have created the diversity of community, that you have created, you know, within your own single body.
But here's the bigger project. How do we get this audience to say, I'm going to Washington, or I'm going to Stanford, or I'm going to my synagogue, or I'm going to this, I'm going to do this? What do we do as artists to move it from the personal to the societal? Anybody can propose it. What do you think?
I think that, well, all I can say is my experience with how we get community to move forward, how we get community to do something, is for us to tell the story. For us to tell the story of who we are and to understand that we are one humanity, to understand that injustice for one is an injustice for all. And I am from an artist's standpoint, that's all we can do. All we can do is to tell the truth of what it is that we experience as artists. And all we can do is follow your passion about what you feel you can do to contribute to making it change. And I think what we need to embrace is the fact that we have leadership roles, that we as artists have leadership roles. I mean, you don't have to be a Martin Luther King Martin Luther King was a great inspiration, but you are a great inspiration. And I think to get people to move is to see exactly what the dialogue is about tonight, which is the social injustice that does exist. And whether the person that you talk about is the most conservative person who also moved me when he said, let's have a flat rate, they know what they're doing. I mean, it moved me. And even though, you know, we probably would just totally disagree about everything else, that was the thread, and that is the thread that will pull me to him and for us to pull to each other.
So this helps me answer your question. I don't think that you are leaving social justice theater because of money. You're going to go to medical school? I think you're moving because you think you can do more there. And I hope you can. And I wish you the best.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us. Good night.
So sad. Thank you so much. Thank you so much again to our panelists for joining. And Let Me Down Easy is playing through September 4th. If you'd like to come back and think more about it, there are still tickets left.